رسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه ومن استنى بسنة إلى يوم الدين. Our praise is due to Allah and Allah's peace blessings be on His last prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. This morning's talk is a commentary on Surah Al-Inshirah or Surah Al-Sharh, which is the 95th chapter of the Quran. And this chapter, like the ones that we have been commenting on in the past sections or the past sessions, is also from the Meccan period. As you know or may not know, the period of prophethood was divided into two sections, the Meccan period and the Medinan period, meaning that a part of the Prophet Muhammad's life he spent in Mecca as a prophet. He spent 13 years there, and the latter part of his life, the last 10 years, he spent in Medina. He migrated from Mecca to Medina. That migration is what is known as the Hijra. And this is where the calendar we talk about, the Hijra calendar, comes from. It dates from the year of that migration. So, the prophethood is divided into two sections. The Meccan period, the first 13 years, and the Medinan period, the second 10 years. Why this division was made was for the purpose of putting the laws which were revealed in chronological order in order to be able to apply them most effectively after the time of the Prophet. May God's peace and blessings be upon him. The Prophet didn't divide his prophethood into two periods. It was done by scholars in the generations that came after, as I said, to better understand how to apply the laws. Because the revelation, the Quran, did not come down in one book as it came to prophets before, number of the prophets before, it came down in one text. In the case of the Quran, the final revelation of God, it was revealed over that 23 years. From the beginning of the prophethood, right up until the very last year of the prophet's life, may God peace and blessings be upon him, the Quran was being revealed. And the verses, much of them, address issues which existed in the time of the Prophet Muhammad's life, in Mecca or in Medina, which had, for the most part, universal value. The revelation addressed issues which had universal value, universal in the sense that the issues which were faced by Muslims in Mecca and by Muslims in Medina, some of these issues are relevant to us today. Those which were addressed in revelation. Direct revelation which became the Quran, the final book of revelation which was to be amongst mankind until the last day. The things which were specific to the time of the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, were also addressed in revelation but not in the Quran itself. Things that didn't have universal value. Most of those things were just addressed through direct revelation to the Prophet, to Angel Gabriel, in which he would say certain things or do certain things to deal with the issues of his time. So, this chapter, chapter 94, is from the early period, the Meccan period. And as we said before, the Meccan chapters, generally speaking, address the difficulties which were being faced by the believers in Mecca. They were under a lot of pressure. They were a minority. Those who ruled the society were pagans, worshipping idols, who were opposed to the message of Islam and who were trying their best to crush it. So Muslims were under a lot of pressure. So many times the verses of this period would address the problems that Muslims were facing, giving them advice how to handle it, to stay firm, holding on to Islam, and that ultimately victory is with the believers. Also, these revelations address the oneness of Allah, because this was perhaps the most significant break with the pagan practices of Mecca. As they worshipped God in many different forms, whereas the final message, as the first message from God, taught that God was one, indivisible, without father, son, or any other relative, but a single God. Now this chapter begins, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I seek refuge in Allah from Satan the accursed. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the most merciful. Prior to reading Quran, we are instructed in the Quran to seek refuge in Allah from Satan, because the Quran is the purest source of guidance for mankind. And the satanic forces would strive their hardest to stop us, to stop human beings, the believers, from benefiting from that revelation. So we are instructed, Allah says in the Quran, whenever you recite the Quran, seek refuge in Allah to protect ourselves, to ensure that we would gain the benefit of the final revelation. Alam nashrah laka sadra. Allah says, have we not opened for you your chest? Now, the opening of the chest, sharah, al-sadr, opening of the chest, has both a metaphorical meaning as well as a literal meaning. The metaphorical meaning that a person, when problems are removed from them, it is often referred to in different languages as getting things off one's chest. Because of the fact that when problems occur, one actually feels a physical tightening of the chest. Like you feel people, when they have problems, you see them always breathe, taking deep breaths, and it's as if they're having trouble breathing. There is a tightness in the chest that comes to it. So when problems are removed, which is oftentimes referred to in different languages as removing something from the chest. So this chapter begins with Allah saying to the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, have we not removed from your chest certain burdens, certain problems, difficulties? And this aspect of it is developed further in the following two verses. But before going into the metaphorical aspect, the literal meaning of the opening of the chest is known well in the biography of the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him. When he was a child, when he was being looked after by a wet nurse, Halima Sa'diyah, in Mecca, an incident had occurred to him. while she was tending to the animals along with his foster brothers. It was the practice in Mecca that infants were given to people from the outskirts, from the, you could call them like Bedouins, those who were not settled in the city, but living on the outskirts of the city. They were given to them to be breastfed and to live among them for a period of time in order for them to grow up in an atmosphere which was pure. Pure in the sense that the child that grows up in the country tends to be more honest than the child that grows up in the city. This is not a new phenomenon. This is something ancient. People have observed this from a long time ago. That the city, with people in close contact with each other, tends to develop amongst the human beings who live in the city certain very negative qualities. Among them, deception, you know, lying, being two-faced, deception. Whereas the people of the country, they tend to be more open, honest. They will tell you things as they are. So, the people of Mecca traditionally would put their children, those who could afford it, would put their children with a wet nurse, that is a woman, in a family, where the woman would breastfeed the child. The child would grow up with that family, out in the desert, away from the city, to develop some of these finer qualities that all human society respects. Secondly, the language of the city tends to be distorted. The big cities, usually people are coming from other societies and living with the people in the city, and they are bringing with them their own dialects and their own languages, and so the language of the city is not pure. Usually it will not be pure. For example, if you compare the Tagalog, which is spoken in Manila, to the Tagalog which is spoken in the Tagalog region, right? There will be a vast difference. The Manila situation, where people are coming from so many other provinces with their own dialects, as well as foreigners coming and living there, bringing in other languages, you know, you have evolved out of all of that, what they call Taglish, I think, a mixture of Tagalog and English and these type of things. This is a normal phenomenon. So again, those people who were concerned about the language of their children being pure Arabic, unadulterated Arabic, would send again their children to the outlying areas so that they would grow up speaking classical, the purest form of Arabic. And this is especially important there because in Arabian society, which was fundamentally an oral society, few people wrote or writing, then the ability for one to speak played a major role. It was considered of great importance. You judged a man by his ability to speak. His state of education was determined by his ability to speak in, you know, in very clear and practical terms. So, because of these reasons, it was the practice of the Meccans to put their children with the people of the desert area to go up there for a period of time to develop certain social characteristics which were admirable, of honesty, etc., as well as linguistic characteristics, having a pure ability to speak the language. Now, the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, was put with a family. The woman who looked after him, her name was Halima, and she had other children. as he was growing up, young Prophet Muhammad would tend the sheep and the goats, which were owned by the family, along with the other children of that family. And on one occasion, while he was tending the goats, an angel came. The other children didn't realize this was an angel. They just saw some being appear, put Muhammad down on his back, opened up his chest, took out his heart, washed it, and put it back in. For them, the other children, when they observed this, this was just something very scary. It just looked like this man or this being was just killing some kind of sacrifice, killing the child. They ran back to their mother, very, very fearful, to inform her of what happened. When they went and they got Muhammad, he was okay. So poor Halima and the others, they just assumed maybe it was some imagination on the part of the child. However, the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings upon him, confirmed that this was an actual incident which occurred to him when he was quite young. And this incident is a part of the divine preparation of God for Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, to carry the final message of God to mankind. He was in particularly difficult circumstances. The immediate prophet before him, Prophet Jesus, Prophet John, Yahya, and those immediately before were either murdered or there was an attempt to murder them. So the prophet was coming after a period in which prophets before him, the immediate prophets before him, were not able, by the destiny of Allah, to carry the message beyond the scope of their own people. Their message was for their own people in any case. But the message which Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, was to bring was the final message, which would be a universal message carrying on until the last day. Now this final message had to be established in the land in a way that the previous messages weren't. Because the previous messages, since they were only sent to limited people in limited places, after the time of those prophets, the message was distorted, changed. Whereas the final message, because God was not to reveal anything else after this, that final message had to be preserved in such a way that it would not only reach a large area of people during the lifetime of the prophet, but also be so established that it would continue to spread in its purity until the last day. That cannot be said for any of the previous messages. The purest, if we were to consider the two existing messages around today, Judaism and Christianity, the message which came to the people of India, what we have to look at for the people of India today, Hinduism, we would be hard-pressed to find where was there a message. We don't doubt that a messenger was sent, because God says in the Quran, وَلَقَدْ بَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ رَسُولًا. We have sent to every nation a messenger. So a messenger was sent to India. But the message which he brought in time became so distorted that today we can hardly recognize it. But if one studies Hinduism, one will see, in spite of all of the idols that Hindus have, you'll see every Hindu has his own personal idol in his home. Their idolatry so far, it's not just one big idol like the Buddhists, for example. They have Buddha, which is their main idol. For the Hindus, each person has their own personal idol. Now, in spite of all of that, if you go and you read the text of the Hindus, the Vedas, you will find behind all that is there, the distorted, crazy stories, wild stories, some of them are pornographic stories that are there, you will find behind it all a message about one supreme being. One supreme being. However, that supreme being, in the message as it is distorted, becomes manifest in three forms that became three gods, which would have the attributes of that one supreme being. So, traditionally, most Hindus believe in a trinity made up of Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. These three gods, one is a god who's called the destroyer, one is the creator, and one is the preserver. But these are all attributes really of one god, but these have been personified in different gods. But as I said, if you look behind, you will find something of the call to one God. And you'll also find along with it certain moral principles and values which have been taught. But as I said, it is mostly quite hard to find, very difficult. Whereas if we look at Judaism and Christianity, we can see the message of the one God and social values more clearly defined. In the case of Judaism, it is most clearly defined that one God concept is very clear in Judaism. There is no father, son, you know, brother, sister, mother, and all these other things. No, in Judaism, one God. In their temples, which are known as synagogues, no images, no pictures of God. And the law, which was brought by Moses, has been preserved to a great degree. To a great degree, the law has been preserved. However, the religion has become a secret cult. It's not an open religion. People are not invited to come to Judaism. No, there is no open invitation. In fact, if you want to become a Jew, they make it very difficult for you. These people are discouraged. Judaism now is identified not just with a religion in terms of principles, but with a race of people, a supposed race of people. So it becomes more cultural and more racial than it is, in fact, religious. It's a closed set of beliefs. And though the Torah, the five books of Moses, or the four books of Moses, though the Torah is available today in terms of the Old Testament preserved here, with distortion, the main book which the Jews follow, which contains the essence of their teaching, is called the Talmud. And this book, you cannot find. You can go in any library, you know, any bookstore, and you ask them, get me a Talmud, and they will not be able to. It is a book which is kept secret from the masses of people. The only places you can find it are in main universities. I know, like in University of Toronto. I grew up in Toronto. Not only a prophet, but a statesman. He became the head of state, and the message, right? The message was established in the land by those who came after him. Prophet Solomon, Prophet David, within that same frame, the prophet of that period ruled, so the law was established. So the outer text continues all the way down to the time of Jesus. That's why Prophet Jesus, may God peace and blessings be upon him, said that he didn't come to change the law or to break it. He came to fulfill it. And that anyone who changes one iota, one single word or letter of that law, would be lost. They would never inherit paradise. So he came to confirm that law. However, after his time, those who came after him changed the law. A new religion evolved, which came to be known in the time of Paul as Christianity. It was no longer the religion which was brought by Jesus. The gospel that Jesus brought, the revelation which he had received, was lost. And the only things that remained in the generations to come were gospels according to various individuals. Individuals whose origins in many cases are not known, who they actually were. So the religion which Jesus brought was changed massively in terms of the law, etc. So what spread, continued to spread, after the time of Jesus, was another religion which attributed itself back to Jesus. It was really polyanity. They call it Christianity, referring it back to Christ, Jesus Christ, but it was really polyanity. Paul is the founder of what today is known as Christianity. He changed the law. He made pig halal, edible. Pig which Prophet Jesus never ate, which the law said forbidden. Paul said it's okay. Everything is clean. As long as you accept Jesus, everything is clean. It is Paul who changed the law with regard to prayer, where Jesus is described as falling down on his face in prayer, making prostration, as Moses was described and Abraham and the prophets before. Paul began the practice of praying with their hands like this, kneeling, which is, if you go to India, very similar to the way that Indian Hindus greet each other. You see them doing this all the time. It's not Sunday teaching. And he changed the law in more ways. He changed the law with regard to God, which was even the worst change that he made. He taught that Jesus was God. He was the Son of God, the only begotten Son of God, and that he was in fact himself God. He became an attribute of one of the aspects of God. God had an aspect as the Father, an aspect as the Son, and an aspect as the Holy Spirit. And the Son, this aspect, would be the judge. On the day of judgment, he would sit on the right hand of God, this aspect of God the Father, and he would judge mankind. So judgment is relegated to Jesus, who is elevated to the status of God. So like the Hindus, who distributed the attributes of God among another set of gods, the Trinity, the Christians did the same. So the message was different. So the final message it was to come had to be established in the land in such a way that no distortion could come to it, because there was no other message to come. So that prophet who was to carry that final message had to be prepared in a number of different ways. Not only prepared in terms of revelation in general, but prepared psychologically, emotionally, etc. To be grown up in a particular way which would ensure that he could carry the responsibility of conveying that message to mankind. So, from childhood, his chest was open. His heart cleaned by an angel, and the separation began. Also, prior to his migration to Medina, after his first wife Khadija had died, and his uncle Abu Talib, who had raised him up, had also died, a year which was known as the year of sorrow, God took up the Prophet into the heavens in what is known as Mi'raj and revealed to him something of the secrets which were revealed to the prophets before him to further strengthen his resolve to carry this message in spite of the most difficult of circumstances. Now, prior to that journey into the heavens, again in Mecca, angel came to the prophet whilst he was in his room, opened up his chest, and again, as the prophet described, poured in it a strengthening of faith. Of course, it's difficult for us to conceive of faith as being something which you can pour. Right? But this is how the prophet described it. These are in terms which go beyond our ability to comprehend. In any case, he was prepared for that journey and prepared for the latter stage of the prophethood, which was the most critical, that of establishing Islam in Arabia and from there to the rest of the world. So there was a physical opening of the chest of the Prophet Muhammad, may God speak to him, and he showed the scar to his companion. It was real, not just on a metaphorical level. But on a real level, his chest was open, his heart cleaned at one stage of the south, and faith strengthening was poured into that heart again towards the end of his period of time in Mecca. Now back to the metaphorical understanding. The next two verses continue that understanding. وَوَضَعْنَا عَنْكَ وِزْرَكَ الَّذِي أَنْقَضَ ظَهْرَكَ. And we removed, Allah using the term we here, not because he is a plurality, but what is known as the royal we, the majestic we, which is used by those who are powerful. And we removed from you your burden, which had caused your back to become bent. The Prophet, like all human beings, when a person feels guilt, or feels that they have sinned, or feel the burden on themselves of burdens which are so great that they can hardly find ways to deal with it, you'll find that they slump. The head will lower, and with the lowering of the head, the back bends. And a person, you see a person walking around like this, you know this person's got a lot of trouble. So the bending of the back is something physical, but it is also referring to that state, that emotional state, where a person's burdened, you know, that they feel as though the weight is on their shoulders. Their shoulders are pushed down by the weight of the burden, though it is psychological. So Allah refers to this period that the Prophet was going through. The difficulties that his companions were facing at that time. They had been tortured. One of his companions, Sumayya, who was a slave, she was tortured and killed. She was the first to die for her belief in the one true God of that period. And her husband, Yasir, he was also tortured to death. And others were being tortured, terrible tortures. And the Prophet, of course, not able to do anything for them in the sense of relieving them of their circumstance. Of course, had God willed, miracles could have been done and they would have all been relieved. But this is not how the message comes. For people to develop, they have to bear burdens and they have to struggle. This is why the prophets themselves bore burdens. And God wished he could have given them no burden. But then they wouldn't be examples to the rest of mankind in how to deal with circumstances as they arise. So the prophet was faced with the burden of his companions being tortured, etc. As well as the burden of whatever errors he committed before the prophethood, these things were on his mind. And Allah forgave that circumstance. In terms of the errors that he made before prophethood, he was relieved of them. Revelation came to him, relieving him of them. Furthermore, the difficulties that his companions were facing, God caused something to take place which started to make these difficulties less. Two major figures in Mecca, Hamza, who was an uncle of the Prophet, and Umar ibn al-Khattab, had accepted Islam. And these two individuals were known for their ferocity, being very powerful individuals who others feared. In the sense of ferocity, you will compare Omar to Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson accepted Islam, you know, that is a powerful figure. Right? Omar was like that. And Hamza, he was known as a hunter of lions. Powerful figure. So when they accepted Islam, Muslims for the first time could start to pray openly. Before, they used to only pray in secret, hiding. But when Omar and Hamza accepted Islam, they now began to pray openly. Because this was a challenge which the Meccans had to back off. For fear of what Omar and Hamza and others like them would do. So there was a certain burden which was lifted from the Ummah at that time, the Muslim nation, the growing seed of Islam there. Those people who were under a lot of pressure, a lot of that pressure was removed because of the acceptance of Islam by these two individuals. وَرَفَعْنَا لَكَ ذِكْرًا Allah goes on to say, and we raise your esteem. In those days, the Prophet was cursed by the Meccans. They made up lies about him. They said he was a magician. You know, he was a sorcerer. He worked with the evil spirits, the jinn. They said he was a liar. They said, you know, a variety of different things. They slandered him. Made many, many lies against him. Tried to put him down. See, and this is the way of the disbelievers. If they're not able to oppose the truth openly, then they will try to oppose it by character assassination. They will slander those who oppose the truth. That is the way of the disbelievers. So Allah, He confirmed to the Prophet that his esteem would be raised above all of them. And surely, his name is recorded in history. So much so, that a few years ago, when one individual wrote a book, non-Muslim, wrote a book on the 100 most influential people in the history of mankind, the most successful leaders, ones who had the greatest impact on human society. Number one was Muhammad. May God speak and bless him. And, of course, those people who opposed him in that period of time. Abu Jahl, Abu Lahab, all these people. Nobody knows who these people are today. They became unknown. I mean, only people who have read the history of the Prophet and come across his names have an idea what his names, who they were. But basically, they were lowered to the point that they were insignificant. In those days, they were big names. Abu Lahab, Abu Jahl, Sufyan, These people who were the leaders of Mecca, their names were big, their names were on everybody's tongue. Just like people talk about Bill Clinton, John Major, whatever. These names, big names. Drama, big names. Similarly, the leaders of the pagans were spoken about at that time. However, ultimately, historically, these names became nothing. Lost in time. Whereas the name of the prophet was raised. So much so that even those who don't even believe in him speak about him. And his name, the mention of his name, became a statement of faith. When a person becomes a Muslim, they make two statements of faith. One, I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship but Allah. Two, I bear witness that Muhammad was the last messenger of Allah. So his name was raised to that status by God, that it would be mentioned till the end of time. A statement of faith for a person to enter into Islam. And also in the call to prayer. In every day, five times every day, in millions of mosques around the world, when the time for prayer comes, the one who calls to prayer also mentions the name of Muhammad, stating in the call to prayer the two declarations of faith. So God promised the prophet to strengthen his resolve that he would be raised and those who opposed him would be lowered. Then Allah went on in the next two verses to say, فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. So verily, with every difficulty comes ease. Verily, with every difficulty comes ease. These verses were repeated. Said two times. Because this is a principle which we must understand to successfully pass the test of this life. This life is a life of tests. We face difficulties every day. And if we don't realize that these difficulties are only temporary, then it is very easy to fall into despair. People have trying times, difficult times, calamities, and they go crazy. They commit suicide. Very common fact. Every week you read about some person tying a rope around their neck to the ceiling fan and hanging themselves. Most of these who are doing it are Hindus. And one may wonder, why? Why are most of the people doing it are Hindus? Because they have in their religion a classical trick of Satan. Satan has put in their religion an idea which is distorted, but ensures that they will not inherit paradise. He tricked them into believing that when you die, you come back again. It's not forever. When you die, you come back again. You're on a wheel. Living, dying. Living, dying. That's what they do. It's called reincarnation. So, if things don't go well in this life, you have another chance. You come back and you have another chance at life. Maybe your next life will be a better life. So this is why they're so willing to put that noose around their neck and go. You have that kind of belief. The trick of Satan. Because of course, when you die, that's it. There's no coming back. But if you die believing that there was, you're going to be in for a big shock when you actually die, leave this world. In any case, the point is that you hear it happening all the time. People under pressure, calamity, children. In Japan, the rate of suicide is rising amongst the children. Because there, you have to, children will study to get into kindergarten. They have special schools to prepare the children just to get into kindergarten. Because if you don't get into the right kindergarten, you're not going to get into the proper primary school, you know. So you find parents putting pressure on their children from they're like 3 years old, 4 years old. They're putting pressure on them to learn this and learn that and prepare yourself. And of course, when they get into school and if they don't do well, the kids just go crazy and kill themselves. High rates of suicide. Pressure of the parents. And we know of many, many other cases where circumstances like this arise, calamities arise, and people not only kill themselves, but they do, you know, all sorts of other deviant or crazy acts. Believing that these calamities cannot be overcome. However, Allah tells us here that with every difficulty comes ease. This is how the test of the second is like. Allah says elsewhere, لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Allah does not burden any soul more than it can bear. The test of this life is never greater than you can handle. This is the promise of God. Why? Because if God were to put tests on you which were greater than you could handle, and then punish you in hell for failing, where would be the justice? There would be no justice here. This would be unfair. But God is fair. God is just. So He designed for every human being the appropriate problem. Problems which will help each individual grow spiritually. Because that's what the tests of this life were about. Spiritual growth. By putting our trust in God, doing the best that we can, then bearing the difficulties that occur, we grow and grow spiritually, become stronger and stronger people. More able to deal with the problems of this life. So, Allah promised twice, not just once, twice, that the difficulties of this life will never overcome the ease that comes after. So we should hold firm to our belief and know that Allah will remove whatever burdens, whatever difficulties you are facing, after some time. But we are only rewarded if we are patient at the time when the difficulty comes. This is when the test arises. Just as the test of fasting, as I've mentioned to you before, the real test of fasting comes when you break the fast. Most people think the test of fasting is during the fast. Stop yourself from eating. Yes, this is a test here. You know, because there's food around, you know there's food, and you stop yourself from eating. Because you know this is what God wants for you. And you know it is to help you to grow also in terms of control of your desires, etc. But the real test of the fast comes at the time of the breaking of the fast. This is what now determines whether you have learned from the fast or not. So those people who tell you, you know, I always gain weight in Ramadan, if they're telling you that they failed, they didn't pass the test of the fasting month of Ramadan. It means that when they broke the fast, they gorged themselves with food. They ate enough to make up for all those hours of fasting plus. It's unfortunate. Most people don't realize it. But the test of the fast comes when you break the fast. That here you must now apply all of the principles that you know are correct with regard to eating. Moderation, that is the general law. The Prophet said that the believer eats with one stomach and the disbeliever eats as if he has seven. He said to eat a third, drink a third, and leave a third for breathing. All of these are principles of moderation. But unfortunately, most people, when they break the fast, all that goes out the door. If they learn that, then they can tell you, outside of Ramadan, they can tell you all these principles. When Ramadan comes, when they're fasting, you see them stuffing themselves. Before going into the fast, stuffing themselves coming out of the fast. And of course, if you do that, you will gain weight in Ramadan, for sure. But as the test is at that time, the tests of this life come at the time of the various calamities that we face. How we handle them at the time that they occur will determine whether we pass the test or whether we don't. Whether we have benefited or whether we did not. So, we are invited to know that every difficulty we face is for our benefit and ease is around the corner. فَإِذَا فَرَغْتَ فَانْصَبْ Allah goes on to say, and when you are finished your obligatory duties of worship, continue to worship. There is no holiday. You know, we work 5 days, 6 days a week, and then Friday is holiday. Or Thursday and Friday, you take a break. After working, you rest, take a break. But for the believer, there is no break from being religious. You're not religious a certain time of year, and then you take a vacation from being religious at the other time of year. People are religious here, for example, when they go to America and England, they take a holiday from religion. When they come to the Philippines, same thing. Many of the Arabs of this region are known for their corruption. Maybe you see them here, they seem to be religious people here. But as soon as they hit Manila or London or New York, because, of course, anyone who thinks that he or she can take a vacation from religion has not understood religion. There is no vacation from Islam. Islam is a lifetime commitment. The worship of God is something which must take place throughout our waking hours. We are not religious in our religious gathering. It's a common phenomenon among women. When they come to a religious gathering, they will wear hijab, everything else. But then you see them at their jobs or elsewhere in the street, and they're wearing something else. So what? You mean God is only present in the religious gatherings, right? God comes when we have our religious gatherings, but outside of that, we take a vacation. These are among the signs of hypocrisy. We have to beware. Because religion, the religion of Islam, is a way of life. Not a set of rituals that we do on particular occasions. In particular, in the presence of particular people. This is not the religion of Islam. Those are rituals which are meaningless. Islam is a way of life, meaning that we are never divorced from it. we always have to be Muslim. And this is why we are instructed in the dua made in the Quran, in which believers are invited to express their commitment, saying, "Inna salati wa nusuki wa mahiyaya wa mati lillahi rabbil alamin." Verily, my acts of worship, the sacrifices that I make in life, my living and my dying are for the pleasure of God, Lord of all the world. This is the commitment of the believer, that every single thing that they do in life is worship. They try to make it worship. They are conscious of God. This is why Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, gave us so many different short prayers to say when you're putting on your clothes, when you buy new clothes, when you look in the mirror, when you go to the bathroom, when you're eating your food, when you step out of your home, when you're traveling in the transportation. Various different prayers that he gave to help us to be conscious of God in the things that we're doing. That whatever we are doing can be transformed into acts of worship, if we are conscious of God. The simplest of us eating becomes worship when we, as the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings upon him, say, "Bismillah," in the name of Allah, before him. If we say that sincerely, it transforms our act of eating into worship. That prayer is to help us to remember God in our eating. By remembering God, reflecting on God, this helps us to remember not to eat extravagantly, but to be moderate in our eating. To make sure that what we're eating is halal, is permissible, not forbidden. So, the life of the believer who is committed is transformed entirely into worship. So once we are finished doing the things which are compulsory, we should always seek to do other acts of righteousness which are rewarded by God, no matter how insignificant we might think they are. وَإِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ فَرْغَبْ. And to your Lord, turn, desiring Him. Ultimately, in this life, it is the pleasure of God which determines whether we succeed or we fail. If whatever we do, we think, is this pleasing to God? We're always turning things back to God. Is this pleasing to God? Then we will make the right choice, and we will inherit paradise. But if we forget God, if we don't turn everything back to God, is this pleasing to God or not? It's not of our concern. This is not an issue. We just do what we have to do. When we have to worship, okay, we worship. Then most likely we will not succeed in this life. Because paradise is earned by those who have true faith. Faith which transforms them into righteous individuals of high moral character. Saying that we believe doesn't mean we have faith. All it means is we have knowledge of what belief is supposed to be. But it doesn't become faith until our actions comply in back to God. By referring everything back to God, then we ensure that whatever choice we make is the right choice. told this to us. Chapter 94 of the Quran begins with a general statement to the believers, the Prophet Muhammad, may God keep and blessing be upon him, and from him to the rest of the believers, that Allah, with our commitment, will remove whatever burdens we have in our chests, in our hearts. As Allah says, Allah bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub. It is only with the remembrance of Allah that heart finds rest. We will never be content. We will never be able to overcome whatever difficulties we face unless we take it back to Allah. Somebody does something to us. This thing hurts us, as it will. But we are never able to rise above that hurt until we take it back to Allah, ultimately. We know that Allah is the judge. Whatever a person does to us in this life, they will meet us on the Day of Judgment. No one escapes. If we believe that, then we don't allow the harm that people do to us to break us down. Where every time we talk to people, we're always talking about this one did this to me, that one did this to me, this one did this. Frustrated life. No peace. No content. Because you're trying to get resolution in this life for everything. Why did this one do this? And how? And how can we stop them? And you do what you can. When something wrong occurs, you deal with it. You identify the right from the wrong. You advise others. And then leave it. Carry on. Your life has to go on. If you keep focusing on that, you'll never find rest. You'll never be at peace. And you'll not be able to deal with people. Because people are always going to do things to you. That's why Prophet Muhammad said, the believer who mixes with people and bears their harm is greater, is better than the believer who doesn't mix with people and bear their harm. The believer said, I just don't want to be. I'll stay away from them. That one is not as good as the believer who deals with the people, bears their harm, tries to correct what is wrong, invite them to what is good. That is the better level of faith. So the surah begins with that general recommendation. And it then goes on to remind us that with every difficulty in life, there will come ease. And it's a principle which critical for us to absorb, take to heart, to believe a divine promise in order that we'll be able to handle the struggles of this life. And finally it closes reminding us that as believers there is no vacation from the worship of God. When we finish one act of worship, we have to consider what next to do. Are there any questions anybody would like to raise on this chapter? The ideas contained in this chapter of the Quran. Our sister raising a question that, of course, we have to, it's important to understand what does this mean. As he said, I said that as a Muslim we have no vacation. But as he asked, what about when I go to visit my parents, family in the Philippines? Now, what it means when we say there is no vacation is that when you go to visit your parents and family in the Philippines, you are still a Muslim. You understand? You're not just a Muslim here when you're around the Muslims here. When you, and you dress in a particular way and all these things. But when you go to the Philippines, then you take off everything, your hair is all out and you're dressed in this way and that and you're partying and you know. That means you're taking vacation from Islam. Right? But if you go, as you are here now, properly dressed, following the principles of Islam, etc., but when you go back, you're the same. You're the same. You've maintained that, then you have taken no vacation. Because it means when you go to your family, you will also there be inviting them to what is good. If you see them wanting to do evil, you tell them don't do it, and you avoid the evil yourself. So you are involved in not only practicing Islam, but inviting people to Islam also. Even though you're spending time with them, and in a general sense, this is called vacation, vacation from your work. That's what that is, it's vacation from your work. But, as I said, no vacation from Islam. Another question? Anybody else would like to ask a question? So, well, let me deal with this topic first. Now, this is a question concerning the opening of the Prophet's chest in childhood. Actually, even the opening of his chest before going up into the heavens, in the what is known as the ascension, neither of these are mentioned in the Quran. But they are mentioned in what is known as the Hadith. Hadith. These are the statements made by Prophet Muhammad, may God speak and be upon him, to his companions. He informed them of certain things that took place. They memorized what he said, they wrote down what he said, and these records have been handed down to us. They're in collections known as the books of Hadith. Well, as I explained there, the issue of opening the Prophet's heart before the ascension. The Prophet explained to us that the angel poured in his heart faith. There is a strengthening of his faith there. The taking him up into the heavens, this also further strengthened his faith to deal with the circumstances that he was faced with. I mentioned that this was the year of sorrow. His wife had died, his uncle, who had been looking after him and had also been taking his side against the other pagans of Mecca, had died, and died without accepting Islam. Of course, his wife accepted Islam, but his uncle did not. And he felt very, very close to his uncle. He was raised by his uncle more than his own father. Father died when he was in the stomach of his mother, and his grandfather raised him for a few years after that. But the one who really raised him throughout his childhood was his uncle, Abu Talib. And it was very grievous for him that he didn't accept Islam. Here was one so close to him, who knew the truth of the message that he was bringing, but yet, out of pride, he didn't accept Islam. He was very disappointed. But Allah informs the believers and informed the Prophet that you cannot guide whom you love, but Allah guides whom He wishes. Meaning, if a person accepts Islam, as much as they would like their wife or their husband to also accept Islam, and how hard they try, simply because you love your wife or your husband, this is not any assurance that they're going to become Muslim, that they will be guided. They will only be guided if they want guidance. If they in their heart want the truth, then Allah will guide them. So the ascension was a form of solace or a sympathetic, kind gesture, divine gesture, to relieve some of that burden that the Prophet Muhammad faced with the death of his wife and the death of his uncle without accepting Islam.
But some people writing that Prophet Muhammad did be with Allah in heaven. Did he meet God in heaven?
No, in the ascension, he did not meet God, meaning that he saw God. But God spoke to him directly. This was the one occasion in his prophethood where revelation came to him directly from God without any intermediary. Normally, revelation would come to him through Jibreel, the angel Gabriel, as was the common practice of the prophet. But we know some prophets, like Prophet Moses, God spoke to Moses directly. This was the main way in which revelation came to him. Not the only way, but the main way. This was special for Prophet Moses. Whereas for the other prophets, the main way that revelation came was through the agency of the angel Gabriel. Further question? Question, what is the punishment of those not yet married? Since I get off the topic, no. Punishment of those not yet married. We don't have any punishment for those not yet married. I mean, we can feel sympathy for them, but there's no punishment. Islam is not a sin to not be married, you know. We are encouraged to get married young. But if a person doesn't find a suitable husband or wife, then it is better not to marry. Because in choosing a husband or a wife, we have to choose properly. If one just marries because they feel, well, I need to get married, and they can't find somebody suitable, they'll marry anybody, then they're liable to have a terrible marriage. They may ruin their own life. So it is better if one has not found a suitable husband or wife to be patient, to fast. This is what the Prophet Muhammad prescribed. For those unable to marry, because they haven't found somebody suitable, to fast. Because fasting helps to control those natural desires which are fulfilled in marriage legally. And of course, it is the duty of the Muslim community to help those who are not married to get married. Those we know who are looking for husbands or wives, and we know people, etc., we should help to facilitate, to help them. You know, because in Islam, it is not considered good character to be hunting around for wives. You know, you asking this one, that one, you know, going up to women asking, you want to get married? This is not really considered in good character. Better character in Islam is that you inform some people who are in a position to help, and they help you to find somebody. So there is no punishment for those who are not yet married. But instead, we should pray for them that Allah help them to find suitable husband or wife. What will happen to a person who collected sadaqah, that is charity, but did not give it to the concerned person? If a person collects sadaqah, meaning that they have informed people that there is somebody who is needy, they're not collecting for themselves. But if they have a need themselves and they are seeking charity, then they should inform people that I have a need. You know, I have some problems, I need help. But if they are collecting for somebody else, they've informed people and they collect this money, and they do not give this money to that person, meaning that they use up the money themselves for their own needs, then that money, the Prophet Muhammad said, will be fire in their stomach on the Day of Judgment. Because it is the wealth of another Muslim. To take the wealth of another Muslim either by collecting sadaqah, which is for them, and not giving it to them, charity, or by stealing some of their wealth in one way or another, we are informed by revelation that it will be fire in our stomach on the day of judgment. Nobody will get away. So it is something, of course, that you should all keep in mind. And generally, that the right, the property, as Allah said in a hadith quoted by Prophet ﷺ, in which he quotes Allah, he said, Allah said that the property of a Muslim to another Muslim is haram. It is forbidden. It is sinful to take the property of another Muslim. Further question? Why isn't there Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim before Surah Tawbah, the ninth chapter of the Quran, yet it is before all of the other chapters? First thing to note is that the Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim is actually not considered, which is written before each chapter of the Quran, is not considered to be a part of the Quran. It's not a verse of the Quran except in the chapter of the Ant, Surah An-Naml. It is only in there that it is mentioned as a verse of the Quran, in which Prophet Solomon is sending a letter to the Queen of Sheba, and it is described there as beginning with, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful. In the case of Surah Al-Fatiha, there is some difference of opinion as to whether it is the first verse. In many copies of the Quran, it's written as the first verse. But if one gathers all of the evidence from the statements of the companions, etc., it shows that it in fact is not the first verse. The first verse is Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Anyway, the point is that since this was placed in the Quran, when the Quran was being written down, and the companions informed us that Jibreel would say it as a means of distinguishing between one chapter and the next. So this is why it was put. It's a small prayer put before each chapter. However, in the case of the ninth chapter, there was a difference of opinion among the companions as to whether the ninth chapter was in fact a separate chapter or whether it was a part of the eighth, a continuation of the eighth. So the Bismillah was not written before it. Now, that is one aspect of the explanation. The other aspect is that those who had memorized the Quran in the time of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had not memorized it with this Bismillah before this chapter. You know, that was not said by Angel Gabriel before his recitation. Scholars, commentators have gone into various explanations as to why, from the meanings of the chapter, why the Bismillah is not appropriate. And again, these things are, you know, reasonings which, without a statement of revelation, you cannot say yes or no. So, it's just enough for us to know that, according to those who memorized it, they didn't memorize it with the Bismillah. And when it was being recorded, there was a difference of opinion. Based on the fact that it was not memorized in the Bismillah, whether in fact it was a part of the previous chapter or not. But in any case, what does that mean to us? It means nothing in the sense that the Quran is the Quran. Whether you put Bismillah there or you don't put Bismillah there, it doesn't change the text of the Quran. The main text of the Quran is hunting. The number, excuse me, of the verses of the Quran, this was not stated by Prophet Muhammad, may God keep him blessed and defend. Those numbers were only put for recitation purposes, to help those people, you know, who are reciting it know where the verses begin and where they end. In fact, if you look at the early chapters of the Quran, the early written text of the Quran, you will not find the kind of divisions we find in it today at all. The text is a continual flow. So these kind of adjustments in terms of the style in which the text is presented, this is of no consequence. It is only according to convenience. What is of consequence is the content itself. And that we know has not changed. It is a pure text from the time that it was revealed till today, not a single word or letter has been added to that text. Yeah. You recite Surah Tawbah without saying Bismillah first. If you are beginning from the beginning of the chapter. However, if you are just reciting a set of verses on any given occasion, then it is also permissible, recommended, to recite Bismillah. However, it is not a requirement. What Allah stated to us before reciting the Quran is to recite what? A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. To seek refuge in Allah before the recitation. That is what is strongly advised by the Quran itself. But if you didn't say Bismillah before reading any part of the Quran, it's perfectly okay. There's no sin. Okay. What we have to remember is that the translation of the Quran is not in fact a translation of the Arabic text. The Quran cannot be translated. All we are doing is rendering the meaning in English. The meaning of this text is then written in English. If we attempt to translate it word for word, we will end up with something garbled, something incomprehensible. And you know this. Even if you translate from Tagalog to English, you know, or whatever your dialect is, or your Visayan or whatever, whatever your dialect is to other dialects, you'll find that meanings are lost. Because many times there are words and phrases which are what they call idiomatic expressions. They have meaning in one language and not in the other. In English, for example, I say, in a term of respect, I say, I take off my hat to you. Now, if you translate this into Tagalog, what is it? I take off my hat to you. It becomes some kind of, you can translate literally, yes, I take off my hat to you, but it doesn't have the same meaning. You know? You understand? So similarly, when translating Arabic, what the translators then do is to take the meaning of the text and render that in English. Now, in order for some of those translators to try to make a distinction between what the text actually says, literally translated, and what it actually means, they put in brackets the clarifying meaning and leave outside the brackets what the text more literally says. That's the bottom line. I mean, it is a confusing kind of way to do it. In my view, it's better to just write it without those brackets. If there are longer explanations, it's better to footnote it. Otherwise, whatever clarifies the meaning of the text should just be written. You read it, finish. In fact, I'm actually involved presently in developing a translation of the Quran which will be free of those brackets. The question is it true that the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, is still alive in his grave? And if so, what kind of life is that? Well, the Prophet informed us that the earth does not eat the bodies of the Prophet, but just himself, of all of the Prophets. From that, people have concluded that the Prophet is alive. However, the Prophet is dead. Allah says in the Quran, "Kullu nafsin dha'iqatul maut." Every soul will die. He died. What happens is that whenever we ask Allah's peace and blessings upon him, that Allah will convey that by way of the angel, convey that to the Prophet, and equivalent blessings from Allah and the angels will be given to those who do so. But this is not having to do anything to do with life as we know. That's why Prophet has said, "Sallu alayya haythuma kuntum." Pray for me wherever you may be. Some people think, well, he's alive in his grave, so we go to give greetings to him when we go to Medina, that we go to the mosque where he's buried, and this is where we ask Allah's blessings for him and so on. But this is not a requirement. He said anywhere, because it is charity to him. No. So, visiting the grave, in general, visiting graves are discouraged for women in the sense of going to the grave all the time because of the fact that women, their emotional makeup is such that going to the grave draws them into things which they shouldn't do. All you have to do is see, when a person dies, you know, a man, he might shake his head, you know, even like this, but the woman will be screaming, tearing her hair, beating herself. Difference in how death affects people. Because of this, you know, and in this state, you find people saying all kinds of things. "God, why did you do this to me?" No. Things like this that they shouldn't say. But because of this, in Islam, women are discouraged from going to the graveyard. Yeah. Only on occasion, but as a regular habit, going to snow. To protect them from these emotional outbursts and things which can affect them psychologically and spiritually.
About the
Visiting the mosque, which is called Qiblatayn. Qiblatayn meaning the mosque having two Qiblas, two directions of prayer. This is supposed to be the mosque in which the message, when the revelation first came, that the direction of prayer was changed from the temple of Solomon to the house of worship built by Prophet Abraham. The people, while in their prayer, when the information came, they turned in their prayer and prayed in the opposite direction, from north to south.